Welcome back to the Kernel Mini Conference. We're now going to have a Kernel Maintainers panel. I hope that the audience has some good questions because I've just been way too busy to come up with any good ones, so I've got loads of crap ones. So we'll let the audience go first, and if nothing happens, we can make up some. So first person for the panel is David Jones. I'm sure many of you have seen Dave before. Yeah, take a seat. Grab the comfy one, the non-comfy one. Dave is the Fedora 2.6 kernel maintainer. He's also like AGP guard, CPU free, things like that. We've got Andy Clean. Andy's here. Andy's the x86 64 architecture maintainer, along with being the nominated x86 maintainer. I don't know if he's ever actually accepted the task. Whipping x86 whipping boy, according to Linus. We have Paul Smakaras from IBM, so PowerPC maintainer, or one of the IBM PowerPC. Have you got an official maintainer for PowerPC? So you. You are. That's okay. There's always patches from everybody. And we have Christoph Helwig, who I just added in because he looked bored on IRC one day. and yes, exactly. And Dave Miller, who's the networking and Spark super maintainer. So, do you want to take that one? I'll repeat questions. You can run between. Well, no, I'll repeat the question if you run between the people. You give them to the panel. So, does anyone have an opening question they would like to ask? Or do you want me to warm it up with some simple questions? Yeah, so I think we're going to warm it up with some start-off questions. So, I suppose everyone wants to know all the basics. So, the quick ones, the via Emacs question, quickly, starting with Dave. Sorry. That mic never. Yeah, go again. It's off, but it's on. Yeah.
Vim. I'm a multi data user. I actually use Emacs and VI and Anadis and some others. And, yeah. I'm actually a multi-editor user. I use lots of different editors, at least three different ones regularly, usually Emacs or VI. So. I use Emacs for editing programs and VI for little things like configuration files and stuff.
I'm already hacking on an operating system and then another one, so I prefer one of the modern VI clones.
Emacs.
All right, that's the easy one. we'll get to a serious question when someone thinks of one, but while we're still waiting for one, or have we got one?
Still not seeing any hands up.
Come on, people, we need a serious question here.
We've got a couple. But what file system do they use?
Dirty.
X3.
How's X3?
X3.
Expression XT3?
EXT3?
Oh!
You might want to use XT3.
What would you identify as being the kernel's biggest problem?
Oh. Pull out the soft already.
The kernel's biggest problem are the questions that Andrew Morton's asking all the time. more automation of tracking the problems. I think that's... God, there's not enough automatic tracking of... Is this like Jeopardy? I got to phrase it. Not enough automation of the tracking of the problems, I think.
Drivers.
Yeah, drivers for new devices, particularly if we don't have documentation. Also, sometimes we have troubles getting subsystems changed or whatever for machines that aren't released yet, but we know are going to be released within the next, you know, 6 to 12 months or something.
I would say code review is the biggest problem, and I agree actually with David that tracking problems in general is a big issue, but code review is the biggest one, I think. I think, in my opinion, code review is the biggest problem we have right now, and lack of code review, yeah. Yeah, but I agree also with David that the tracking problems automatically is a big issue.
They already took all the best answers. Increasing reliance upon having to trust things at the BIOS to do things right, and especially ACPI, because BIOS vendors just historically have never been able to get anything right, and so increasing the dependence on them getting things right just seems like a really bad idea.
I'll shut it up. So basically, I just wanted to more of a, have you any great opinions on wireless device escape stacks, considering there's so many of them? Go to Dave first.
Apparently, the networking maintainer has an opinion.
Since Jeff and John Linville on here, I'll speak in their behalf. So this way you can't pin this on me. actually, the device gate stack is going pretty well. There is some re-architecting that they want to do. There are some locking issues, which I think have been mostly taken care of. There are some SMP issues. It's going to go in eventually. It's just a matter of when it's in the form that's ready to go. John's completely on top of it. He knows exactly what they're up to. They're interacting with us very well, so I don't anticipate any major problems at all.
I think it might also be worth noting that there was a wireless summit. Was it last week or was it next week? It was overlapping with this somehow. Next week in the UK. You'll see progress, I'm sure.
Yep. Up top.
How better are the changes for the
San Diego? I think that's just for Dave.
Please attend my talk on Thursday morning at 9 a.m.
I thought we're better.
Someone else there? Oh. Annie.
So that was about removing the timer interrupt and dynamic ticks in the kernel?
Should be going in soon, like it has missed 20, maybe 21 or 22, but there still are some bugs to be worked out because it's interacting strangely with some hardware, but it should be going in soon.
Anything else coming around?
I say new, but it's not really new. The new 2.6 release process where we're rolling in more frequent, larger changes and not having an odd-numbered kernel release. I presume we're all happy with that. Do we like that?
Okay.
Particularly, I guess, from Dave Jones from a distribution point of view.
I know.
And related to that, what would it take to be numbered 2.7 or something, or are we going to be 2.6 forever?
What in your opinion, would make it a 2.7? Give your opinions on what would make it 2.7. We can ask Linus later.
Right now, having a single tree makes my life a lot easier. I'm buried alive in bugs and problems with just one kernel, so trying to tackle two right now wouldn't happen. So I'm pretty happy with the way things are right now, and that's for when 2.7 is happening, that guy.
What you really missed is that except for the numbering scheme and the time it takes for a new major release, we're pretty much back to the old development cycle again. Just no one noticed.
2 months, 2 years.
Difference. Exactly. So we're basically back to a development stream model, except that we release far more often, which is a good thing. So, yeah, I think that's the short answer.
From my perspective, what we had in the odd number systems is we could do something like, okay, here's something we're going to turn completely upside down. Everyone agrees that this is the direction to go, but for the next few months, only two or three of the major drivers are going to work, right? And you could do things like that, and things that took an enormous amount of time to propagate through the whole tree and fix everything up, we could do stuff like that. Or maybe we were working at a slower pace back then. But like, for example, since it was brought up, the Van Jacobsen net channel stuff, that's something I'd like to be able to, like, okay, we'll wash away everything. We can make like only a couple of core networking drivers work and get the basic infrastructure working, and then over time get it all work. But now, with the way 2.6 is, you could argue the other way and say, well, you could be doing that in your own damn tree, Dave. Why do you have to mess things up for everyone else? So maybe it is actually working out. But I kind of miss the odd series, to be honest with you.
So I have to say, I absolutely love the new system because what happens now is we get bug reports so much more timely manner than we ever used to get before. And an example of this is, I mean, Dave Jones also likes the new system, but the reason I like it is because the Fedora test tree has now, for the last year or so, actually tracked my kernels within a matter of weeks or something like that, which really means that we get tons better feedback when something goes wrong. So instead of being in the situation where a year later, we're told that we broke some application that kernel developers don't run, we get told 2 weeks later that, oh, by the way, you broke that application for me. And that just makes my life, and I suspect 99% of all the other kernel developers' lives, so much easier. You just have a much smaller set of changes that you have to worry about at any particular point in time. And that alone is just worth the lack of having the ability to say, we break everything. And I also think we've reached the point where we don't actually want to be in the situation where we break everything. It used to be useful. I don't think it's that useful anymore. As far as I know, right now my plan is there's going to be a 2.6 until somebody really smart comes along and just wrests control from me and just says, hey, I will do a 2.7. And when that happens, all the more power to him. And everybody will think he's crazy, but somebody will come along and actually make it work. So as far as I'm concerned, it's 2.6 for the foreseeable future.
I just want to ask a related question on that to the panel. What do you think of the efforts by certain people to try and keep a stable 2.6.16 kernel traveling through life?
What do you think of Adrian Bunn? No. Adrian Bunn's efforts to keep 2.6.16 alive.
Nice try.
I'm sure it's useful for somebody, and I'm not gonna crack a guy for doing the work. I mean, since he's the bunk bot, he does everything automated anyway, so might as well let him go loose on it.
But I'm just wondering, from the point of view not of giving out about it, I'm just wondering, if you had to do something similar, do you think how long you'd be able to do it for? What sort of possibilities?
I don't know. I mean, some people are so perverted they'll do it for months at a time. I can't speak for other people.
Any other questions?
In the last few months, there came the surprise specialization project named KVM along.
Do you think that we still need Xen when we have KVM? Do we need both?
Xen sucks, end of story.
Give it to Christoph.
Okay, that was just a short remark, but I think it's an interesting topic for research to find out whether you want a small hypervisor or that as a separate function for a full-blown OS. The latter definitely seems simpler and more usable for the normal user. Then again, even if you want to do a small hypervisor, Xen is the wrong solution to that. It's just a bunch of crap.
Well, I think even if I wanted to go Xen to go away, it wouldn't go away because it's basically already established enough that it won't be going away anytime soon. But I think it's interesting because it's good that there's more competition in the hypervisor space than just having a single option. Yeah? And I think the Linux hypervisor, has a lot of potential. That's because Linux is a good kernel, and if you have a good kernel, you get a good hypervisor. Obviously, or likely, and of course, to be honest, like KVM right now and L-Hype, which are basically the Rust divider, are right now alpha or pre-alpha software. So right now you cannot say they are a replacement for anything. They are still in heavy development and will probably give some time until they are really usable for end users. Okay, you can already use them for some things, but nobody claims that. I'm not saying it's not easy. Not the problem is that it's not easier to use, but it's quite a buggy. It doesn't run a lot of stuff. It crashes regularly. Of course, Xen is also buggy, but it's in a different way, and it's already quite widely used. That's the difference.
Then Xen isn't either. I know your employer likes to ship it, but then again.
There's another point here. Crap is good in the sense that crap shows you how not to do stuff. No, seriously, we wouldn't have L-Hype and KVM so feverishly being written on now without the incentive to get rid of Xen, right? So it was a good thing. Right, you have to try things multiple ways, and that's where we are right now. That's a good thing. Of course.
It's at least widely used. Sorry, Ben, but that's not true. It's widely used in production. It's widely used in production. Sorry? Not for me. Okay, that's not true. I have systems running with file size. I want to comment on that. Actually, I must say my mailbox, I think, is still stored on Riserside. So for a long time, I'm using it in production. So it's not that's nobody using it. And it's a stable file system. But anyways, I'm not to defend anybody. I'm just saying that in practice, it's used and it's stable. Yeah? Okay.
Okay, anyway, so we will, of course, at some point see like a bunch of preferred solutions. That's what you probably said with the file system analogy. But that's going to take a few years at least. And I mean, similar to file systems, you probably will have virtualization solutions or hypervisors that just fit one certain task better than another one. So yeah, whatever.
One thing I want to add, because everybody is saying KVM, but in practice right now, KVM only works on a small minority of the x86 systems that are out there, because it needs IWT, that's the Intel virtualization extension in hardware, or the AMD one. And even though, in theory, Intel supports it for a long time, most BIOSes don't enable it, or you have to choose strange things to enable it. And on AMD, it's also only in the very new CPU. So practice, most PCs that are in the field right now can't use it at all. So definitely they need to. Okay, there are trade-offs also between different hypervisors. That's another thing. For example, there are cases where the just doing an recompiling like VMware does is actually faster than any of the other solutions, for example. So it's not obvious that you can say a single solution is the best for everything. So, and in the end, I think we will have a wide range, and essentially the users will decide. I don't think anybody can force on the users this one will win, but it's yeah, of course. I mean, it's already like this. For example, you already have Xen, VMware, Parallels, QEMU, and some other things that can run guest. And, I mean, the users are using all of them. So it's not that a single one is the dominating one. And there will be more in the future. Yeah. And there will be probably, of course, it's different when the distribution ship a default one. Yeah. So there will be, but I guess expecting there will be multiple default ones even, because there are different use cases. For example, new hardware, old hardware, workloads, whether one works better, workloads, whether other works better. So probably they will be having, because the users want to have choice, or they're not even forced to only run the stuff that's on the distribution. They can just download themselves. So, and we will win. We'll find out in a few years. Huh?
We end up with pretty much one virtual driver interface per type of driver multiplied by the number of hypervisors out there. And that sucks. Like, at the end of the day, you end up with, I don't know, scratchy drivers, and you end up with more hypervisor drivers than actual hardware chips in there. And that's something we can try to do something for. I don't know, there was some work in the area. I don't know what the status is.
Yeah, I've actually been encouraging the Xen IA64 people to implement the IBM vSCSI interface.
This is a really serious issue because you're not only multiplying by N x86 hypervisor installations, there's Niagara, there's PPC iSeries, there's so many different implementations of these virtual devices. Some do message passing, some pass buffers directly, have a direct API to call. It's all different, and we don't want 1,000 drivers. We should try to comment out this stuff as much as possible.
I think this brings up an interesting problem, which I think is even more important than the Xen VARs. That's like many hardware vendors now come with a built-in mandatory hypervisor, and a lot of them are just crap. And I think it's much more important that we just have any free hypervisor we actually have control over than choosing which particular one, because these hypervisors that aren't hardware take away a lot of freedom. They make code run really slow quite often. They're a total pain to deal with. For example, the virtual drivers, where we have like tons of them, or other issues where the interface is just very suboptimal.
I was thinking about those two and quite a few more. Yeah, and that's the architecture that we're not going to mention here.
I would say, in my opinion...
There's 10 minutes to go on sale.
Thank you.
Okay. In order to prevent this from turning into the virtualization panel discussion, I'm going to take another question. And Pat Michelle's had his hand up for ages, so.
So sorry to change the topic off of virtualization. I know how much everyone loves it, but in each of your opinions, what is the sweetest, most bitchiness, up-and-coming project that you see going on today, either in the kernel or out?
I'd really love to see more people get involved with making Nouveau work, because I think that's a really useful thing that a lot of people will be able to get a lot out of. It's a reverse-engineered NVIDIA driver. Yeah.
Come to my talk tomorrow. I'm up against the world PC, so I need a lot of people.
Well, on the kernel side, I'm relatively excited about system tabs, for example. We'll see what's coming out of that. I'm hoping that basically more people are doing cool things with that on the kernel that are not normally hacking kernel. Other than that, can't think of a good one right now.
I've been encouraged to see the revitalization of X and the whole graphics display side of things with DRM and DRI and all that stuff seeming to be developed and coming together. And, you know, hopefully within another year or so it'll be really good and the equivalent of anything on any other system.
I don't think there's a single totally standing out project, but like, two very interesting ones that are going on are this KVM VRL tool too that actually turns Linux to Hypervisor or the RustyVisor as well, which is in the same area. The second other thing that I find very interesting in area I'm a little bit involved with is the whole block device and SCSI target thingy, because that means we can like replace NetApps and all these filers that do like storage serving over different protocols with Linux boxes with a nice unified framework. A bit too technical, sorry.
Inside the kernel and with the kernel source tree, I think all the automated analysis tools are the really cool area. That's where the stuff that's going to help us in the long term manage this enormous source, complicated source tree. I mean, as much as we can automate, we should. So that's cool. A little bit outside the kernel, but related to virtualization. Sorry to bring you back to topic. One thing that this makes track all this virtualization stuff, where you can have all these virtual machines on a single system, it makes tractable is management of many hosts. Most people don't have the facilities to test and implement that kind of stuff, but now it's just trivial. You can actually, normal people can just work on this stuff now, and I think that's really cool because I think that's the interesting problem space once we take outside of the kernel. Because yeah, we have to figure out which hypervisor implementation is the best or whatever. But outside that, the big problem that has to get solved is how to manage all these systems.
So I'm actually going to jump back to virtualization for a second. Sorry, but. No, but I do have a related question. I mean, something. I come from an embedded background and work with a lot of embedded vendors. And one thing that scares me about virtualization that I know the embedded chipset, embedded equipment guys are interested in, is they don't want to run Linux as the hypervisor. They want to run something else with the hypervisor and use that to completely hide the hardware interface from Linux, running on top of a non-open hypervisor. And that's something that what's your opinion on that? And something somewhat related to that in terms of hiding hardware interfaces, I know Greg KH and Thomas Gleixner and my employer, Embedded Monta Vista and Wind River, other embedded guys, are interested in user mode device driver support in the kernel, some sort of stack to do that. My personal opinion outside of my employer is no, but I'd like to get your opinion on that.
So about the hypervisors hiding hardware, actually, we could write a Linux hypervisor for the Niagara chip because they've documented the whole hypervisor level of the Niagara chip as well, and they've put the whole silicon design online too. So if you really think they're trying to hide something from the docs, you can go and check. You can double check them. I know, but as a there are examples of where they could be wanting to hide the hardware specifications. So I definitely think that could become a concern. But currently, I think it's at the alarmist level. It's not to the point where it's a big deal yet, I don't think. Second question was about user space device drivers. I think those have a limited scope. I think we've already learned how difficult it is to share access to a device with the X server. Right. So nothing over to you, Keith, but seriously, it's a difficult problem. There's a reason why we have protection levels. There's a reason why we put some stuff in the kernel and some stuff we don't. And sharing device access between those two realms is non-trivial. So that's my opinion on that.
So I'll continue with the user space device drivers. There are device types where it makes a lot of sense, and there are a lot of device types where it doesn't make any sense at all. And I'll give some examples. You have a machine that's like in an industrial environment, and you have a single process that just controls this machine. There's no point in not controlling this machine directly from the program using a user-space device driver interface. Then you have a hard disk or hard disk controller. It only makes sense to pop that in the kernel because you want to have it at the ring where you don't want a context switch for every IO request. And you have the file system talk to it, which is in kernel space 2, is a fundamental kernel abstraction. And there is no point in putting a disk driver into user space. You always have to think about what you actually use this device for. So having a user space device driver interface is good, but that doesn't mean we're going to move all or even the majority or probably even any but 5% of the drivers into user space. And about the hypervisors, so we actually have a lot of cases in practice where we have hypervisors that are only there to take away our access to the hardware. And I mean, Sony is a very good example for that, both in the PlayStation 2 and the PlayStation 3. We have mobile devices where they try it. And I think that's generally both bad for Linux and for those vendors because they miss off half of what they really get as an advantage of using Linux. That is people trying to help to improve their code and fixing up the drivers because those specific hypervisors don't seem to be the best ones either. So that actually get helped if people with a clue would deal with their hardware instead of their engineers. So, well, but what should we do about it? We can just tell people not to buy the stuff and they're not going to listen to it anyway.
Yes, in the case of the Sony PS3, for instance, where Linux running on it doesn't actually have any direct access to the graphics card, you can sort of understand that their main focus is as a games machine, and we're not going to say you shouldn't be selling the PS3. And I guess we should be happy that we can run Linux without having to resort to any nasty tricks or hacks. But then, on the other hand, it is a bit disappointing that you can't get to that hardware that's there. I guess it's why you have to think about why you're buying such a thing, I guess. Are you buying it as a games machine and then you can run Linux as well, or are you buying it primarily as a Linux machine? If you're doing that, you have to be aware that the graphics performance under Linux is not going to be so good. But it's relatively cheap, I guess, for a box. Sorry? How much? For how many gigaflops? 240 gigaflops?
IBM sold
right, but what do you want to do with it? No. So, yeah. As far as the user space device drivers go, I mean, I can see that, for instance, you could do a soft modem like that, and that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Yeah, well, there you go.
I'm just commenting on the user space drivers. I think for low-level hardware access, some of the problems are just not solved, like, for example, interrupt handlers. Nobody knows how to do interrupt handlers in user space. But I think what makes sense is doing some high-level protocols. For example, if you have a new USB device, then you don't need to write a kernel driver for it. For example, you have a new camera or whatever on USB, and you can just write a user space program that speaks the USB protocol and uses the low-level USB drivers in the kernel to do talk to the camera. I think that makes a lot of sense. Or, for example, the soft modem does a good example. But for direct hardware access, it's often difficult.
Yeah.
like a block driver typically provides a service to the kernel file systems. A network driver provides service to the kernel network stack. If you have a USB printer driver, I mean, you do actually have no reason to have any kind of interface to the kernel at all. So the only case where you do not actually provide any service to the kernel system, you might still want a kernel driver, are cases of very high performance or very low latency kind of things. But that's generally the rule, is whether you actually provide the service to the kernel.
There are actually lots of user space block drivers and network drivers. For example, all the hypervisors or all the virtualization, starting with QEMU and others, are basically doing loopback dot invoking from the guest to the kernel. So there's lots of, for example, there are various solutions. You can basically do use any of block transfer protocols, user space, and then use that. So, but they exist and it's used in practice. So I don't think it will go away.
Yeah, so to just expand on the list Ben gave, there is one important reason you want to put a driver into the kernel, even if it doesn't use any, it's not used by kernel service, and that's resource sharing and like access permission. It's like if you have, for example, a typical sound card. It's not actually used by any kernel services. It's not exactly high performance either, unless you do high definition audio. Now, I'm not going to plot it for the X server, but if you look at this hardware, it usually has multiple channels, and you somehow need to like arbitrate between them, and you don't really want 10 different processes dealing with different parts of the sound card from user space. So you need to have someone who's doing the resource arbitration. That's what the kernel does for definition.
Yeah. Just from my graphics opinion as well, so you get user space drivers, people go, well, NVIDIA could put their graphics driver in user space. That's not going to help you. There's a problem in the graphics driver. Your machine is still going to die, and you're still not going to be able to fix it. It just won't, they won't be making GPL-type violations, but it's not going to help the end user. So all we're doing is like saying, oh, well, it's not illegal anymore, but it's still making crap out of so many people's machines. So it's not really helping the problem. So I don't see it as a solution for that. And also, with people said, oh, we can put parts in the kernel, parts in user space, but that runs into the problem that how do you know that the parts in the kernel are actually going to secure the card, because without specs for how a graphics card works, you don't know how it's going to be secure or how the DMA engine can get main memory and stuff like that. So there's a lot more to it than just going, move the driver into user space, we don't have to worry about it. You know, it's still going to cause problems with still security issues and things that you have to think about.
David wants to go, so I'm just going to one question here and start hand up, and then we'll call it quits.
Yeah, just shut up. Mm-hmm.
G'day guys. Local vendor gave me a thing to play with, a little NextG wireless packet modem, and gee, it's fun using that in the outback, but how do I actually get a driver into the kernel? How can I get you guys to help me figure out how to make it work? The vendor's turning up here on the open day on Thursday after 3 p.m, so what can we do for?
First Greg. We actually have there's a mailing list called Kernel Mentors. I forget where it's hosted, but Google will probably find it. And it's exactly for this purpose, for vendors new to Linux who want to talk to kernel developers. How do I get this into the tree? What do I need to do? What kind of cleanup do I need to do? And it's very sort of, you know, we'll handhold you all the way to get this into the tree. So that would probably be a good first place to head.
So you're saying that you want to get a driver going by Thursday?
NDIS. So where does NDIS come into it?
Sorry?
Where does NDIS come into it?
Well, network.
So it's not PPP over some sort of serial emulation? Well, we can do PPP.
They can do NDIS as well.
Yeah. Usually with USB devices, if for a vendor to get it somewhere, it's like send Greg a couple. He might actually pull a driver, because he's pretty quick at getting drivers done for things these days. Do we have one more? I'll just shout it out, please. Just shout out the question.
All right, just for the rest of the audience, let's say the question was, what type of testing and QA did they do on their incoming patch streams? Probably don't want to answer this too truthfully, because Linus and Andrew are here. But
personally, it depends on the patch I'm flying. If it's simple, I'll just try to write some little test programs that really exercise the thing that the person's touching, make sure it builds too. If it's a build, it works, right? For something more like infrastructurally, like doing something serious to the way the networking buffers are done, I'll just run like things like LTP, LNBench, things that stress and bandwidth tests, make sure things don't get slow over time. Actually, this is an interesting issue tangentially for the networking TCP in particular, because now that we're messing with all these congestion control algorithms, since we have a pluggable congestion control model, the IETF old farts are getting concerned that we're gonna crash the internet and everything's gonna melt down because we're toying with these algorithms so much, which is a legitimate concern. And so Stephen Heminger and some other people and has been trying to interact with these IETF folks and try to come up with a way that we can test and validate this stuff over time in more of a way that makes the researchers and the core IETF folks feel comfortable, yet let us experiment with new stuff at the same time. So that's my answer.
Well, I don't really apply patches, so I can only tell how I test my own stuff. And it's like, if it seems trivial, a patch, I usually just try to boot it and do something that exercises it, which sometimes isn't enough. When I do real serious stuff, I start to think and write small test cases for it, but I just have like with a simple test driver called make, and it's just basically a bunch of test programs.
Well, in my case, I'm mostly handling patches for different PowerPC type machines. And like Dave said, it depends on who the patch is from. If it's from someone who's recognized, like if it's a patch for some PowerMac thing and it's from Ben Herrenschmidt, I'll probably just apply it. Or if it's cell stuff and aren't affected, then I'll put it in. And then before I ask Linus to pull a string of patches, I'll at least compile test on probably at least 8 different configs and try and boot some of those. Not all of them, because I don't have all the machines. But and at that point, if I find a problem, I then go back and say, well, which patch was it that caused the problem? But mostly I'm relying on people on the Linux PPC dev list to do reviews, people like Christoph here and Ben and Art and whoever else, in addition to my own reviews of the things. So it's a sort of cooperative model in that sense.
Well, it's difficult because when you're working on low-level hardware architecture, there's a lot of changes that you get are actually for specific hardware, which you usually don't have, so you can't actually directly test it. Like, for example, it's completely different when you're working with networking, which is high-level, which you can usually test on all kind of hardware. And what I usually do is, it depends also on who submits the patch. So if I trust the person, then it goes easier, and otherwise, it's just a very close review and so on. I do usually, before I submit anything, I do at least boot tests. And for bigger changes, I also do... Sorry?
Boot on one machine? Or?
No, boot on multiple different kind of machines. It depends. No. Between 3 and 7 or so. There's something like this. I cannot boot on much more than that. I could probably boot with a lot of effort, boot on more, but it's rarely do... Yeah. And... infrastructure test. And also when there's bigger changes, I tend to run stress tests, basically run some LTP stuff and some D-bench and some other things to stress the system and see what happens. Occasionally, also when for new features, I try them myself and I simply test programs or try the interfaces from just manually and see if it crashes on my box or not. But I cannot do a complete retesting of what they are submitting. So basically, I must say most of the testing is done by after it's released. Or usually what we do, the way it works right now is it gets to be pulled into MM, and there people start to test it. And then after it has been in MM for some time, then it gets over the Linux tree at some point. I used to have an own tree for that, but it didn't scale because the problem is that when everybody has an own tree, then people who want to test different things, they have to decide which tree to test. So it's better to have a single test tree.
You think with the amount of bugs that get reported against the Fedora kernel, I wouldn't have to really go looking for new bugs. But sometimes I just write to a little program that will just exercise an interface that's exported to user space, for example, the syscalls, and I'll write a fuzz testing tool to bombard them with random noise and just see what happens. And that tool, every architecture it's imported to so far, it's fallen over. PPC64 was first, Spark was second. And there's a number of different ways you can get really interesting, like just try passing zeros, try passing all Fs, or all sorts of strange things. But these days, because that kind of testing has already been covered quite a bit, you've got to be a little more clever now, because most syscalls, the first thing they'll do is check that the first argument that gets passed, does it match one of these three inputs? So now when you're fuzzing these interfaces, you have to make sure some parts of it look sane and just give it noise in some of the other sort of arguments you get passed. So that's what I'm doing for testing, really, just trying to break things that are not supposed to be broken.
I think what Dave's actually saying is when he gets given a patch, he just pushes it out to all the Fedora users and sees what happens.
Wait for it to come back. All right, I think that will conclude our kernel maintainers panel. Thank you very much, guys, for coming and doing it.